Jessica, a grateful member of Conan.
Okay,
let's see, can I move it? Is it okay if I move it? Okay. All right, so what I've been taught by my sponsor is to share what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. And what it used to be like for me is I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm actually one of those strange birds that's from Phoenix, Arizona. There's not a lot of us. But I was raised in an alcoholic and a drug addict home. My dad was a very high-functioning cocaine heroin addict, which is very weird to even put into one sentence, but he was really high functioning. And we had a lot of fun growing up. You know, my parents were not abusive at all. Very loving parents. My dad was the life of the party. He taught us how to play poker at a very young age. And we used to have parties, and they'd have, you know, they'd be drinking and smoking weed, but we didn't really know what it was except for we knew the smell. And I remember going over to friends' houses, and their dad would have that same smell. And I was like, oh, my dad does that too, you know. And everybody's like, shh. And I'm like, huh, you know, because we just didn't know, you know. But and they also had a cigar box too. Like they rolled their, you know, things in the cigar box. So they had the same cigar box, which is funny to me now looking back. But it's funny now that I look at it. It was those kids that were like the dysfunctional ones in school. Like we were kind of the same. We had a connection with each other, you know, and I think it was already like that dysfunction or the isms coming out already at that age, you know. Anyways, my dad, I think I was about 13 years old. Let me back up. I remember when I was probably about 8 or 9 years old, my grandma was an alcoholic as well. And my 8th or 9th year old birthday, my grandma got really drunk at my birthday party, and we were on this merry-go-round, and she felt like we were going too fast. And my grandma weighed about 125 pounds, I think. And she grabbed onto the merry-go-round, and the merry-go-round dragged her. She wouldn't let go because she was drunk. She didn't realize what she was doing. And it just tore her up. And my grandma was the most important person in my life. Like, she was precious to me. And I remember thinking, I do not know how I would be able to live life without her. And it was really scary. I was probably about 8 or 9 years old. And I was really scared. And I remember coming over to her house afterwards because they had to take her to the hospital and she had to get checked out and stuff. And I remember coming over to her house and she'd already been drinking again. And I was like, had high anxiety. I mean, I remember as a little kid, I remember walking in thinking, oh, I hope she's okay. You know, what's going to happen? What she's going to look like. And I walked into the house and she was like a real fun drunk and she was just crazy. And next thing you know, I look at her and she's doing a headstand. And I remember I was so mad at her because she just hurt herself, you know. And I'm like this little kid that's like 8 or 9 years old going, what are you doing? Like, you need to grow up, you know. And so I learned at a very young age that behavior that's exciting and fun, but also not appropriate. It just isn't appropriate. And so, you know, through my life, you know, my mom worked really, really hard and my dad played really, really hard. You know, on top of being a drug addict, my dad also was a gambling addict. And I think when I was about 13 years old, one of my little sisters super glued her eye shut as he was getting high in the bathroom. And that assisted my dad in hitting a bottom. And so he came out and told my mom that he was using heroin and that he needed to go to treatment. And, you know, my dad had had cancer when I was younger. And so, you know, for many years, even though like the chemo was 3 years ago, he was still blaming his nausea and vomiting from doing heroin on the chemo that he had 3 years ago. You know, my mom was, I don't know if she was naive or exactly what it was, but she just continued to accept it, I guess. I don't really know. So he went to Valley Hope. And he was inpatient there for a while. And he got into Narcotics Anonymous and got and was sober and was really involved for the first few years. And as far as us as a family goes, though, like we would go on some of the trips with them and some of the picnics and learn some of the slogans, but we really didn't learn that it was a family disease. We didn't learn. What I did learn is that it's hereditary, and if I smoke pot, there's a possibility that I become a drug addict. That's what I remember learning from my parents at the time. And I remember that they, you know, that we would go, and all the kids of the Narcotics Anonymous group, all of the kids would go, and we would find a way to get in trouble. I remember one time we went on the one of the NA trips, and there was, like, these other kids that we met, and they were making moonshine, and we all, like, totally got into the moonshine at this NA trip as our parents were, like, celebrating recovery. It was really funny. And so... you know, but our family did change and life did get better. My parents didn't argue as much. And my dad started talking about like these statements, like I feel this way, you know, and like just, he started communicating, his feelings versus watching TV or going to the horse track. 'Cause that's what he did. And I remember through being a kid and also to my somewhat teen years, you know, remembering that I just wanted to be one of his friends or I wanted to be a horse so he'd pay attention to me. Like, that's how I remember crying in my room, God, why didn't you just make me a horse so he could love me the same way as he loves the horses at the track? And, you know, I mean, truthfully, that has carried over into my adult life. You know, the different not being fear, my fears of not being important, drove a lot of the decisions that I made in life with my relationships. The fear of not being good enough, you know, the fear of emotional abandonment. A lot of that stuff really laid the blueprint for what my relationship career was going to be like. And, you know, I don't blame it on my dad himself, but I do blame it on his disease, which is very different. You know, I've learned here that it's two different things, and which I'm really grateful for because I can love my dad. I just don't have to like his disease. So, you know, I think I was about 15 years old and I 15 or 16 years old. And I decided that it was time to find a boyfriend. You know, everybody else had boyfriends and, I was really, pretty naive. I had gone through, parochial school from kindergarten to eighth grade. And then I went to this big, huge high school that was mainstream high school, which put me into shock. Because going from a parochial school where there was, you know, only white kids there, truthfully, I mean, that was it. I think we had one person from South America to Central High School was like the ghetto, you know. It was pretty rough, I remember. And that was like the same year that my dad got sober, too. So I started there and, you know, and I was really a high achiever. I was really like a people pleaser, wanting to do the best. I was the oldest of four girls, always seeking attention through being better or perfect and doing it the best. And it served me really well for a long time, up until probably about 3 years ago when it started being really destructive in my life. But during that time, I had... you know, was going to date a couple of people. And then I went to the mall and I was really naive. And I met this guy and he paid some attention to me and we sat and we talked for quite a few hours. And as he was working, we talked for a few hours. And I remember he engraved something for me and I think I was with my sister and, we went and got him a rose, which is like totally ridiculous now that I think about it, but whatever. And wrote down on this little flower card, you know, it was kind of like peer pressure. My sister's kind of like, you're a chicken if you don't do this. And I couldn't be a chicken. So I wrote out like, you know, thank you so much. If you call me, I'll pay you back. And like, I'm like, you know, not the type that pays people back type thing, you know, at the time anyways. And he ended up calling and he ended up, you know, coming. We went on our first date and... after that first date, like, I was part of his family. Like, it just instantly happened, you know. And I was almost 16 at the time. And his family, you know, I remember missing that. And, like, we had a lot of fun in my family. And we had a lot of love. My mom loved us. My dad loved us a lot. But there was this intimacy of that I was really seeking in unity. For some reason, like, my spirit was born for that unity. And I'm sure that it was there. It just was never good enough for me. I was always searching outside because what was always right here present, and actually the Courage to Change talked about it today, but what was here was never, ever good enough. And even if I got what I wanted, it was still not good enough. I would still want more, or to get more, or that person to like me, not this person, even though now they like me, I want this person to like me, you know? And, I had, you know, went and met up with his family, and they like played games and ordered Pizza Hut together and drank Pepsi together and ate steak dinners. And his mom was, you know, wore makeup and really took me under her wing and really like taught me how to put makeup on. Cause my mom was like hippie-ish. So was my dad, you know, they were like kind of hippie bikers almost, which is weird, but they were. And, I just clung on to their family, and what happened is that I got that fix that I was looking for from out here temporarily. And then when they started talking about how they had moved here recently from Colorado because the dad had gotten in trouble because there was drugs in the basement, and like that feeling inside, like, uh-oh, red flags, this isn't okay. Well, they had to do it. You know, and like I just started making these excuses, like they had to sell these things so they could live, you know, and like I start those morals that I had internally started to kind of go wayside because I wanted to be part of so badly that it didn't matter what my internal self said anymore. And that went on for a long time. It did. I ended up getting into a lot of trouble in that marriage. Emotionally, physically, and spiritually. And a lot of damage was done in that relationship. My husband was an addict. He wasn't an alcoholic. He really didn't drink a lot, but he was an addict. And not only an addict of drugs, but also an addict of a lot of other stuff that's really, really harmful to people's spirits and children's spirits. And that put me into some really bad stuff happened in that relationship, and it really rocketed me into a deep depression to where I pretty much didn't sleep at all. I didn't live. I wasn't living. Actually, I was like a walking zombie. I just totally exited life, and I almost like that batter woman syndrome type thing. Like that, I became brainwashed to a degree. Like once I would pull away and I would kind of get away from him for a little bit, and I'd start feeling, well, what would happen is my brain would start going crazy and thinking about, well, trying to decide if he's telling the truth. Is he not telling the truth? What about this? What about this? What about this? And then I'd start making sense. And then as soon as I started making sense, it's almost like he knew it, and he would come back and like manage my brain. It was like having a puppeteer with me, you know, which I graduated out of nursing school the day after I graduated high school. Like, I am a really strong-willed person, you know? And so, he just, you know, he got into my brain and pretty much just completely stole my soul. Or, you know, I let him steal my soul. I didn't realize I was letting him at the time. You know, but that's what it felt like happened. I became very scared of him. I became very scared pretty much of everything that was outside of me. Even me. I mean, there was nothing. There was no peace whatsoever. And I got to the point that I planned to get rid of him. And I'm grateful that I didn't talk about it out loud a lot. Because I don't know if I would have been here today, if I would have. But it made a lot of sense to me at the time because I didn't feel like there was any way out. You know, so I ended up getting pregnant. I had two children and became, you know, just really became an obsessed mom. Never, like I said, never slept, really just involved with them. I also, you know, exited with some substances as well. I decided, you know, I took the route of, you know, drinking and all that stuff. And Today I know it was a tool that I lived by because I didn't have any tools to deal with it. And I'm grateful that I had that tool because I believe I wouldn't be here if I didn't have that tool at that time. And so, he ended up, my son was probably almost a year and things got really bad between us. Crystal meth was a huge part of our home. And he started getting really violent and it was really, really ugly. And I remember, you know, the insanity of it and lying for him and, you know, and just the destruction that it was doing to me and the kids. And my daughter was almost four and my son was almost one at the time. And he ended up getting caught stealing money at his work and he ended up having to go to jail. Now, I will tell you, the day that he got picked up, I thought was the worst day of my life. But, you know, it's really funny how this program works because what I realized is that those things, those dramatic life changes that happened for me has always been God doing for me what I can't do for myself. Always. It's never been in a place where it's not just a huge gift and it's not because God, I mean, God just, I'm able to see it today. It's because he loves me that much. You know, and he ended up, you know, he ended up going to jail and ended up getting sentenced for like 3 months at the tent city and work furlough. And like the brainwashing stopped. And I actually, there had been a huge amount of secrets that were in my home that I had not told anybody except for his sister and his dad who supported the secrets. And I really believed that I could never heal from those secrets and I was going to probably be locked up for the rest of my life for going crazy. And one of my girlfriends, you know, I had, right after he went into jail, I decided I wanted to take this soul-searching trip. And I was praying and I actually told her what the secrets were. And, you know, it just taught, you know, you just tell one person what's really going on and God has a little room to get in there to bring some light into that darkness. And that's what happened. You know, we went to California and I remember I was on the beach and I was like, she's like, give it to God, you know? And I was totally not doing God's will at the time at all. I was like, my life was just crazy, crazy then. But she's like, give it to God. And I raised my arms and I was in the ocean and I grew up on the ocean. So I knew how to ride the waves and all that stuff. And this wave came and hit, like knocked me down. And I like did a couple flips. And as I'm doing the flips, like my wedding rings were taken off and into the ocean, gone. And it felt like God's hand took them off me. And I remember standing up and not being able to breathe because I knew what I needed to do and I was scared to death. But I knew that I was empowered by that. Like, okay, I hear you. We're going to do it. And I couldn't breathe. I remember just like, you know, all right, we're doing it. You know, and I came back to Phoenix and I filed for divorce and I left him. And despite the fact of the threats that he made and you know, I know that there's no way that people get out of that without a higher power. There's just no way. Because, you know, there was just a lot of threats that my kids would be taken from me and I would never see them again. And, you know, and I don't know, something magically happened inside of me. And so I ended up leaving him and I ended up going back to, I think I was at my parents'. I went back to my parents' house and probably about, I don't know, 2 or 3 months after that, I had gone to a counselor and she had told me that because of living in the family of alcoholism, that I might want to try to go to Al-Anon. And I was like, yeah, I don't think so. Like that, not so much. That's my dad's problem, you know? And she's like, well, you might want to check it out, you know? And it's like, okay, you know, and that actually was the last time that I went to see her because I didn't really get anything from her. And so, and it's funny because it took me a while after, it probably took me another like year and a half after that to go to Al-Anon. But now looking back, I'm like, God, why was I so stubborn? It's just amazing. I mean, I know you get here when you get here, but, you know, I wish I could have, you know, saved a couple relationship pain issues, you know, that would have been nice, you know. And she told me, you're just going to continue to repeat it. You're going to continue to repeat the cycle if you don't get help. You know, I'm like, cycle, what are you talking about? You know? So, and I did, I repeated the cycle. There was a guy that worked at my work, and he said that he was in recovery and that he lived in a halfway house in Phoenix, and he had 4 months sober. And I was like, that's awesome. You know, I remember my dad got sober and life got better. And so he's going to be like an awesome guy. You know, he's in recovery. And so and he had something in common with my family, so they're going to like him, you know? And so I started dating him. And I think within a few weeks, we ended up moving in together with two children and my two children. And right before we moved in together, he relapsed and started drinking again. Of course, you know. And I really, really thought I had some sort of power over his drinking. You know, and he had talked about his cocaine addiction at the time. And I remember, and you know, and he started doing pills, and he started doing, you know, a lot of drinking. And I got to the point that I was insane with his drinking. And now I'm on round two, and I'm like, how am I here again? How did I get here again? Like, I just got rid of one a month, you know, a year ago. How did this happen? You know, and so I ended up going to his parents. His parents had told me about Al-Anon. And so, and they lived in Sun City. And I decided that I would try one of those meetings out because I was at a loss. Like, I was going crazy. I didn't know what else to do because I would come home and there would be vomit all over the place. And I was working a crazy amount of hours. And, like, he was supposed to watch the kids, you know, like, he can't even not drink four quarts of beer by 10 o'clock in the morning, but you're supposed to watch kids, don't you know? You know, and I was just, again, here I am in this powerless situation, you know? So I ended up going to this Al-Anon meeting with his parents, and I remember, like, a lot of them were talking about their children, and I was their children's age, so it was kind of uncomfortable, but at the same time, there was this peace and understanding and a breath of fresh air, like I could actually breathe in this meeting. And it's like I went once, and then I started going again, and then I started going again, and then I started going twice a day, and then I started attending Al-Anon and going. And I had been in Al-Anon for probably about 4 months. I think it was like 3 or 4 months. Now, I will tell you, the reason why I was going to Al-Anon at first was to get some tools to figure out how to get him sober. Like, that's the truth. I still did not believe that I had a problem. I knew that he was making my life unmanageable. I was in such great delusion that I really didn't see that I had harmed anybody, that I wasn't selfish, that I really didn't have a part. If he just got his crap together, then maybe we could have this family, you know, and that I so wanted, you know, and it just continued to spiral down. And he started spiraling down, but what was happening to me is as I was going to these meetings, I started to get a little bit of hope, and I started to get a little bit of strength. And pretty soon I started setting boundaries, and pretty soon living in the situation that I was living with him in, with suicide attempts. And I think our first year together, there was like 9 different treatment centers. I mean, it was insane. He was a real alcoholic. And we ended up going to some of the family treatment centers, and I went to the family treatment, and I really got a lot out of it. We went to, I think it was Banner Scottsdale, and I did. I learned a lot, you know, and I started getting connected with people even more so in recovery. And I started really praying, and I started to develop a relationship with God, and I started to learn what the, you know, and I actually knew what the powerlessness was by this time. Like, I learned that there was, you know, I think I remember being in the bathroom this one time, and he was like at the point throwing up blood and laying by the toilet, and both of us were just crying, and he was so soul sick. And I remember looking at him thinking, who is sicker? Like, he can't control it. What makes me think I can? Like, that is just insanity. And I don't know, something changed, you know, something changed. And I remember going to this Al-Anon meeting, and there was, it was a pretty big meeting, and I remember my car, like, I didn't know how I was going to fully get there or get home because my car was overheating and my kids, like, looked like orphan children. They didn't, I don't even think they had shoes on at the time. Their hair, my daughter's hair hadn't been brushed in a long time because I was trying to manage everything to make everything look okay. And I couldn't anymore. Like, I could not make it look okay anymore. It was done, you know, and I pull up to this meeting. And I remember they asked if there was anybody, any newcomers. By this time, I had been in Al-Anon for probably about four months. And they asked if there had been any newcomers. And I actually raised my hand because I felt like it was the first time that I came in as a newcomer for me and not trying to get him sober. And that was really, truthfully, that's when my recovery began, was at that point. I mean, the other stuff it did, it got me to that point. I call it step zero. My sponsor calls it step zero. You know, you get to step zero and then you start working on step one. And I just remember, like, I raised my hand. I felt like a total worm crawling into that meeting. And I got connected with some really good Al-Anon groups out there. And I got connected with this woman that is a black belt Al-Anon who works the steps out of the big book. And I started to, that person, I was a little bit scared to ask to be my sponsor at first because she was real serious about recovery. And I didn't know if I was serious, but I didn't know if I was that serious. And so I didn't ask her. Plus, she didn't have a star by her name, so that helped. I was like, oh, good. It's not God's will. I won't have to ask her. And so I asked this other woman, and what was really funny because it happened to be her sister. And I didn't even know that, though, for like 6 months. I had no idea that they were sisters, which they look alike. And they both have a southern drawl. Like, I don't even – like, they're both from not Alamo, Texas, but – oh, well, it doesn't matter. Some part of Texas, very small city, town. And so, you know, and I remember her sister started taking me through the steps, and like my life completely started to change. I always like sought that power through a man or through circumstances or people to make me okay, make me happy. And now all of a sudden, like I was just doing the work in this Al-Anon book and out of it. I don't know if I was doing the AA Babe book at that time, but doing the Al-Anon work and just showing up for meetings, showing up for service commitments. And like, I started to change. Like, it didn't matter if he was at home drunk, I was doing my own thing, you know? And then I started to be like, this is not a safe situation for my kids to live in, you know? And so I remember, I had started getting really, really involved, and I had gone to, I was working at a care center, and there was this woman that I used to do some service work with, and she was actually a heroin addict that had overdosed. And she was in the wheelchair, paralyzed for the rest of her life. And I remember going to this church service with her, and I was sitting right next to her, and I was just in a bad place with a boyfriend I was with that was in the halfway house that was a real alcoholic, started getting physical with me. And at that point, I was like, I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore. And I was looking for an apartment that was like two-bedroom apartment with a washer and dryer and a fireplace. And I had $400 budget. And I was really mad at God because he wasn't providing it. Like, didn't you see what I was doing? I was showing up to do service work with people. And I was like doing what I was supposed to, doing the next right thing in front of me like my sponsor was telling me to do. And now, like, you won't give me an apartment to keep my kids safe. Like, this recovery stuff just doesn't work, you know? And so I ended up taking this woman to this church service, and we were sitting there, and I remember that he shared about something, and then all of a sudden I, like, heard this is just temporary in your life. And I remember looking at the heroin addict that was sitting next to me thinking, wow, like my dad did not have to go through this, and he's a heroin addict. I did not have to walk this journey, and there's a lot of people that have harder journeys than I did. When I got here, I felt like I had the hardest journey in the world, and everybody should know why I am the way I am and then feel sorry for me and let me know it's okay. You know, it's okay, honey. You continue to live like this, and we understand. And that's really not what people did when I got here. They're like, you have a choice. I'm like, huh? You know, you're continuing to stay a victim. And I'm like, oh my God, if you say that victim word to me again, I'm going to put my foot up your butt. You know, I mean, I hate it. I hated the word victim when I came here. And it's probably because I was being a huge victim, you know. And so I had like a spiritual experience because I realized that my life was really good and I was just being selfish. And that, you know, and I thanked God for my life at that moment. And I don't think I had ever thanked God for anything, pretty much. You know, I'd never had that perception. So my brain started to change, like they talk about in the steps. You know, that psychic change started to happen for me. And I started to become a mom, like a mom, a present mom, not just a mom that takes care of physical needs, but the mom that, you know, that I wanted to be, like that I would get that feeling of when you go on a first date with someone, like that happy feeling. Well, at least that I get, I mean. I started to get that when I was getting ready to pick my kids up from school. You know, and I wanted to be that person. I just didn't know how to be that person. And I started being that person. And I remember, you know, just my life really started changing. I mean, I'm pretty young. I was 24 when I got here. You know, thank you, God. I do attribute that I did kind of know where to go because my dad was sober. And, you know, and my life just really started getting better and better and better. And I remember that there's a part in the big book where it talks about if all of your ideals are grounded in a power greater than yourself, then your life will be recreated. And I remember this one night, I had taken my daughter to this church service, and I showed up, and like there was all these parents around us, and everybody's married, and I was like the single mom there, which usually could put me right into self-pity, you know, because I didn't plan. This is not the life I planned. The life I planned was to get married, have children, raise them, grow old together, open up Christmas presents with each other when you're like 70 years old and have false teeth, and play, you know, and play with each other, you know. Like that is, I don't know about the false teeth that just came out, but it just came out. So anyways, but you know, really and play games. And I had this ideal. You know, and it was grounded in Jessica, though, because I never prayed about God guiding me, you know, and now I'm, like, praying for God to guide me, and I'm in this church thing that my daughter's up there, and she's singing, my God's so big, so strong, so mighty, and he can do anything for you and you and you, and I am so excited inside. I do not even see that I'm a single mom there with my kids and everybody else is married. I kind of did, but I was so excited that I was like, wow, I'm enjoying this instead of looking like I'm different and I'm defective and they're judging me. You know, like this is changing for me. And I remember I'm videotaping her and my heart is so big for her. And I'm like, how is this happening? Like, this is so who I wanted to be. You know, this is what I've wanted. And nothing else. In fact, my outside world looked probably the worst that it have ever had. I'm 24. Five probably at this time, and I'm at home with my parents living with two kids, and I mean, and it was just absolutely amazing, you know. And so I stayed single for probably about 4 or 5 months because I have a addiction to needing to be loved, I guess, I don't know. And I met this guy that at a roundup, a CA roundup. And he was really nice, and he paid attention to me and the kids. And I remember coming home and calling my aunt on sponsor and saying, we will not. First of all, I needed to wait for a year until I was fully in the program for a year before I would actually date him. And I only had 9 months in the program. So I had to wait. So we just talked on the phone. We were friends for 3 months. And then, like, literally within that year, we started dating, and I think within 30 days he moved in with me and my parents. And I remember calling my sponsor and telling her, though, I promise you, I'm not going to let him move in for 3 months. I've got a 3-month boundary. And I remember I was getting off I-17 on Bethany Road home. And I remember the place and the turn when I was turning, and I was called my sponsor and told her, and she goes, well, what about that commitment you made? And I'm like, huh? Well, it's just temporary. It's just temporary. He's only moving in just until he finds a place. And she's like, you know, God bless her. Because the thing is what I've learned here is we don't tell each other what to do. We honor each other on each other's journey. But she'll ask questions. She's got these famous questions. And then she screws all my plans up with those questions. It sucks sometimes. You know, and so he moved in. Within the month, I got pregnant because I was irresponsible. I didn't think that I was pregnant. I took 3 pregnancy tests because they would lied. All of them lied to me. And And I was pregnant. And about a month and a half after I found out I was pregnant, we ended up deciding we were going to get married. And about a month and a half after I was pregnant, he relapsed. And he ended up demolishing his work. And he ended up in jail. And at this time, he was on probation and had only been out of prison for 3 months. I didn't hear that when he asked me out, though. I did not hear that. I didn't hear that he had been in prison since he was 12 years old, and now he's 30. Like, I did not hear that. All I heard was, like, you're really pretty. You know? I mean, that's what I heard, you know? I really like you. Your kids are adorable. I just want to be a dad someday. You know, those are really sweet words to my ears, you know, at the time anyways. And I didn't pray. I mean, I did pray about it. And I remember I went and did amends to my grandma, and it was right before we started dating. And my grandma had passed away by this time, and I was at her her gravesite, and I was reading my amends letter to her. And I remember, so what are you talking to her? What do you think about Greg? And I remember, like, this ant came and bit me. It was like a red ant, too. And, like, my hand swelled up, you know. And I was like, oh, that's just a quinky dink, you know. That's not a sign. That's a quinky dink. So let's go with them, you know. And you know, of course, that's, you know, self-will, you know. And I do believe today everything happens in God's world. Nothing happens in God's world by mistake. I mean, because what ended up happening is I did get pregnant. And my life felt like it fell apart. But again, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And it, having, you know, my daughter Desiree has been probably one of the best gifts of my life on top of my other two kids. I really believe that she's an angel on earth that came down to help heal our relationships. And to be able to, you know, me and Autumn had a lot of healing to do, and she, me and her would laugh. We would be so mad at each other, and then Desiree would wop up and say something so funny, and me and her would just stop arguing and start laughing together, you know. And through my pregnancy, I was taken care of by the 12-step fellowships, and it developed my relationship with God, a personal relationship with God that was unbreakable. Absolutely unbreakable. To where I was driving down the freeway, I had no idea how I was going to be able to pay for tags. My car broke down. I hadn't eaten. I was pregnant and I was feeling sick. And this police officer pulled up behind me. It was morning rush hour traffic. He let me get in his car, plug my phone in to his car, call my dad. And then he stopped traffic, pushed my car off the road, and then drove me to Waffle House so I could get something to eat. You know, and that's the kind of stuff, like, that stuff didn't happen to me before I got into program, you know, because I was like, I'm so grateful. Before, it was like, woe is me. My nickname was Eeyore when I got here, before I got here by my old friends. Like, people called me Eeyore because I was a lot of fun to be around. And so, you know, and that, and things like that just happened. And you know, my relationship with my kids just continued to grow. And after that experience of him going to jail, and I kind of really got to the point where I probably should stay away from relationships for a while. and I did. And I was by myself for close to about 2 years. I mean, I had some friendships, but nothing as far as a relationship goes. And then I did end up meeting someone that was in recovery. And he was just a really nice guy. Really, just a really nice guy, you know, and we just really connected. You know, we did go to the Shoestring Roundup, and I got really scared and decided that he had just gotten divorced, and I had said that, you know, you need some time to heal, so it's not a good idea that we date. And then I started working my steps and realized that I had a lot more healing to do, that I had a lot of baggage left over from my ex-husband. And part of my amends to my ex-husband is, and men as a whole, is not to treat men out of my past wounds, you know, which definitely I need God's help to be able to do that, you know, and to love them unconditionally no matter what. And, you know, and so part of that was wanting the best for someone else. And I never cared about anybody else but myself and what I was getting. I mean, that's just the truth as far as relationships go. It's, how are you treating me? What are you not doing for me? I'm such a loving, amazing girlfriend for you or wife for you, and look at, you're doing this. you know, but if I'm in that space, then I've missed it for me. Because today, I love to genuinely love someone, not to get anything in return. If I'm not getting anything in return, that's their stuff. That's not mine. God gives me everything I need. You know, I don't have to, you know, it's nice. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I love to hear my husband say, I love you. And I love to, you know, which I ended up marrying him, probably about 4 years later. And we waited to move in. I actually was friends with him for 7 months before we even dated, which was a very, very different situation. And then we were with each other for 6 months before we moved in together, which was very different than what I had done. And so, you know, and our relationship is very, very different. I mean, that was 10 years ago, you know, and we are, we've been married now for 6 years and have an amazing relationship, not perfect. But the beauty of it is he works his program, I work my program, and then God does us, you know, and we just really respect each other. We don't tear each other down, you know. In the How Al-Anon Works book, there's a great description of what a healthy relationship looks like. And it's not about stealing from my personality or anything like that. It's about nurturing each other. And that's really what our relationship does look like. You know, I've experienced a parent that's a drug addict, a grandparent that's a drug addict. I have two sisters that are drug addicts. I think one is 30 days sober right now. I don't know for sure. One I just saw for Mother's Day for the first time in almost 2 years. She's 24 years old. And we grew up really close as we were young, but she's on her journey today. You know, I don't find it necessary to try to get in there and control her life today. One, I don't have the power to. I can try, but all that does is make me sick and her sick. And, you know, the beauty of it is I don't really care. If she's using, she's using. It's not my place. It's none of my business. But what I get to do is when she's there and I'm present, I get to be a present sister and I love her no matter what. And I hadn't seen her. She's been like kind of AMA except for stopping into my parents a few times every now and then to see her little boys. But on Mother's Day, I decided to take my mom a Mother's Day card and some flowers and a little gift. And my sister was there, and I looked at her, and her eyes are yellow. You know, she's got some health issues going on. She's 23, 24 years old maybe. Already far, far advanced addiction and alcoholism. And I got to give her a hug, and I got to hold her. And I take those moments as possibly the last time I'll see her, and I hold on to him. I just hold on to him, and I'm so grateful. That was the best Mother's Day gift that I got. It was amazing that I got to see her. So I still hate this disease at times. I'm grateful for everything that it's given me and the self that it's given me, but I hate the destruction that it does in families and the destruction it does to people's spirits. You know, she's a beautiful, beautiful spirit, and it's really, really just devastated and rocked her world. You know, and again, I love that I don't know, when I got here, I couldn't differentiate the person's spirit, you know, from their disease. That was just all enmeshed in one. And it's just such a gift that I don't have to be angry today at that. I don't have to be angry that someone's doing this to me. It's not about being angry. And on, you know, God bless my mom. She's like the disease of codependency is just huge with her. And she just lives in that space of disease and not being free. You know, and I'm not, I feel very blessed. You know, I've also have a daughter that started using when she was about 11 or 12. I thought it was just that she had really bad PMS, which is funny because I've been in recovery like for, you know, 10 years or something like that. And she started using and I'm like, yeah, it's just really bad PMS and her medication's not working anymore. And it was because she was drinking and started smoking weed, I think, at a very young age. And then she kind of went crazy. She got caught at school with weed and she kind of went crazy. And, you know, this program, that's when I really started getting involved in Kohanon, It was probably about, I think that her maybe third relapse maybe. You know, and what this program gave me is the ability to take care of myself and my other children. It's like bringing the traditions in my home, you know, because it can't just be about her and what's best for her. It has to be about our family as a whole, and then God's our ultimate authority. And, you know, it was the last time that she relapsed. I had gotten to the point where you can continue to live like this. She was 15 or 16, but I'm not going to continue to live like this. And I'm not going to have the other kids have to live like this because we're affected by your disease. It's your choice if you want to live in it, but you have a choice to make. Either you stay here and you live in a place of recovery or you move out. That's your choice. So if you choose to leave, just know if the police officer calls me and they say, hey, your daughter is blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, she chose to leave because she wants to get high. So, you know, this is your choice. And she chose to leave. She did. It lasted for a week. It lasted for a week. And within a week, she came home and she's like, Mom, I know that I'm a real alcoholic and an addict. And I just want to know if I do what I'm supposed to do, can I come home? And I'm like, of course, you just have to do what you need to do. You have to take care of your spirit, you know. And she's kind of, I mean, I feel bad for her to a degree. Like, her using career was really screwed at a very young age because I knew a lot, you know. I had a lot of experience. And I knew that you had to take care of your fit spiritual condition or else you don't get to continue to have the gift of sobriety. And, it's just a beautiful thing today. She has... she celebrated 18 months sober last Saturday at SNL. It's a huge meeting in Phoenix. And she's working at Sprouts, and she's getting ready to actually move back home. But it's amazing to me because she calls me and she's like, Mom, she's like, I'm feeling really scared right now and I'm really pissed off and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, what are you scared of? You know, and I get to walk through the process of what the fear inventory is out of the big book. And I get to walk through, and it's kind of weird because, like, I kind of go into just like it's like a program mom type feeling, and you know, it's just really amazing to be able to have that connection with her, you know. And if you would have told me this is what my life looks like, even 4 years ago or 5 years ago with her, I would have believed you then. 12 years ago, no, or 14 years ago, no, I wouldn't have believed you. But 12 years ago, or 4 years ago, I would have believed you, but I would have been like, we need to ASAP get there now because this pain is just too much, you know. And I don't know. I haven't found it necessary to stop going to meetings. I became a step junkie when I came in here. I think that it's really important to bring the steps into Conan. I think that when I started going to the Conan meeting with Donna, it really... was in the need of that recovery piece and bringing the steps and the traditions. And it's been amazing to see how much it's grown. You know, we've had our annual picnics and, you know, I haven't been able to participate as much as I'd like to because I've just been spread thin. I'm also in another program and I have a family. But, my spirit's still there, and I'm like the backup. Like, okay, what do we do? Like, this is not the quiet backup. That would be a lie because I'm not quiet. I'm very loud and obnoxious sometimes. But, you know, it's just amazing to see what the recovery is happening in the family. And I think that because I have experience of my dad getting sober and the family staying sick, that, like, I have this serious mission to, like, for people to be here. Like, how many cocaine addicts are out there? You know what I mean? Where are their families? Like, you got, okay, I am on this now. Like, I am really on this. Like, can you educate your family that there's a place for them so they can get some help? Because if you don't, guess what's going to happen? They're going to start dating drug addicts like you. You want that? Okay. I mean, I don't know if they come in here. At least my pain didn't have to continue until I was, like, you know, 80 years old or something. You know, at least I'm educated, so I now can make educated choices. And I can make choices through God today. I can make choices through working the steps today. you know, and it does frustrate me, and it makes me really mad that there's not a lot of education that they bring into their family. And I'm sure maybe I have a resentment towards my dad, obviously, maybe that's what it is, but it doesn't really matter. There's a purpose for it. There is a reason for it. And we have really, I've used that energy, I believe, to push myself to even take on more and we do a 12-step workshop, every year. And I think last, you said it first and then I said it to you back, but, and just to see the families changing, you know, and our meeting grow, you know, and over the years it's gone down, it's come back up and gone down. And I don't know, I really just want to bring recovery into the family. Like, that's what we get sober for. You know, that's what it's about, is bringing the stuff to the family and being able to have patience, tolerance, kindness, and love within the family. You know, and sharing this together. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. It just really is. So thank you for asking me to share, and thank you for all being here and doing what you do.